Hi, this is Aaron Newcomb, and on this episode of Floss Weekly, Randall is back. He's joining me to talk to Josh Berkus and Colin Walters of Red Hat about Atomic Host. It's a platform for running containerized applications. You're not going to want to miss it. It's coming up right now on Floss Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Aaron Newcomb and Randall Schwartz. Episode 403, recorded on September 13th, 2016. Atomic Host. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at BraintreePayments.com/floss. And by Drobo, a family of safe, expandable, yet simple-to-use storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your most important data forever. To learn more, visit DroboStore.com and use the code TWIT100 to save $100 off select Drobos. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Floss Weekly, which is, of course, the show about free Libre open source software. I try not to say that too much, but that's what it stands for. You guys are probably sick of hearing it all these years. But this is a show about open source, the projects, and the people who make them. I'm Aaron Newcomb. I'm your host, at least for today, because joining me, a lovely co-host that you've all been waiting to see again after such a long time, it's Randall Schwartz.
Hey, Randall, it's good to be back. Hi. Hey, everybody. I'm back.
Randall's live. Finally back. Indeed. Randall, it's so good to have you back. I know the audience has been going nuts since you've been out, but we're glad you're feeling better and doing better and able to be on the show. And I'm going to do the heavy lifting today. We're going to ease you in slowly here, but I know you'll be back up to speed here real soon and back to the normal Randall who goes crazy over open source projects.
Well, consider this my audition tape, I guess, for me. We're getting back my old position. I mean, really, it's like, how well do I do as a co-host? Let's see. Then we'll see how well I can do as a host next week or whatever. So, yeah, that'll be good. Yeah, it's for those of you actually watching the video, they may go, wait, who is that guy? They hired a stunt guy for Randall. I actually lost 20 pounds since the last time I've been on this show, mostly wow. Due to really bad hospital and rehab center food that was mostly carbs. And if anybody has been following my change in diet over the last 3 years, 4 years, they know that I don't eat very many carbs. So I would leave two-thirds of the plate, two-thirds of the tray completely uneaten. And I started apparently eating my own internal fat, which is okay. That's what that's there for. And so I ended up losing 20 pounds. And so I'm now at the skinniest I've been since high school. That is guaranteed. Lost a couple inches around the waist as well. So I may stay this weight. It's kind of cool. I may gain a little bit of it back, but I don't really care because I was out of my goal weight, 20 pounds heavier. So I'm just happy to be here, and I'm happy to be out of rehab. It was not chemical rehab. For those of you that couldn't figure this out from my tweets and stuff, I had a physical injury that required me to relearn how to balance myself on my legs. And so I was in a wheelchair for a few weeks, and finally they let me walk around with a cane, and now I'm walking around without any kind of assistive device. In other words, I am back to normal, baby. I'm ready to go. So except for the weight that I lost somewhere there in the hospital and the bills I'll end up having to pay, I am feeling good.
Great. Well, we are certainly glad to have you back. And I know that you've been in the chat room a few times for some of the shows, which has been great. Asking your own questions. You're on the other end of the stick. And so that was kind of interesting. But really glad to have you back and looking forward to getting things back into the normal routine. And so and we'll get there. In fact, we're going to get there today. Go ahead.
Aaron, before we go, before we start, I just want to say thank you for your work in taking over the show in my complete absence. Because, you know, when they first put me in the hospital, I couldn't even, you know, I was incoherent. So I'm glad you sort of figured that out and took over the show, and you've been doing a wonderful job. So I wanted to not get too far into the show before I was able to say that. So thank you, Aaron, for doing that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No problem at all. I love doing this stuff and been doing it a while. So it's no problem whatsoever. Always great. Happy to help. Yeah, great. So, yeah, without further ado, let's kick the show off and get back into the swing of things. We have an interesting show today. We're going to be talking about Atomic Host, which is part of Project Atomic at Red Hat. And this is going to be interesting because this is all about, we talk a ton about Docker and containers, and it seems like every other show we talk about some aspect of it or Kubernetes. We must have done 20 shows now talking about, seems like anyway, talking about either Docker or something related to Docker. And this is another one of those, but this is a little bit different than our other shows because this is actually talking about a distribution or an operating system which appears to be purpose built, so to speak, for running these containers. So we talk a lot about how do you get your container to do this or that or whatever, but this actually seems to be an OS, or like I said, a distribution that's designed exactly around running lots of containers and purpose built for running containers, which is great. Do you know much, Randall, about Atomic Host or Project Atomic?
No, I stuck around. How this project got on this show, actually, by the way, is that I went to I was invited actually as Floss Weekly to go down to the Red Hat Summit, which is held every year, and Red Hat showcases all their commercial vendor partners, but also showcases there's sort of a community area. And as I'm walking through the community area, I see none other than one of our guests today, Josh Berkus, who was actually my first guest on my first episode of Floss Weekly back in 2007. I can't believe we're doing this show that long, but talking about Postgres. But he was talking about Atomic Host and the whole Atomic program, which sounded to me a little bit like CoreOS, because I know CoreOS has been stripped down to really be friendly with containers and really just have just the minimal bare stuff. But it sounds like Red Hat has now sort of brought that philosophy in camp, and is supporting it much more directly, which is particularly heartwarming for their commercial customers. And one of the other questions I have is I see that the demo instructions talk about RHEL, and I'm wondering if you have to be a commercial customer to use this or whether this is also available on a community level. That's going to be one of my early questions if you don't get to me before I do. but yeah, so it'll be great to see Josh again after 9 years of distance. And it will be great to find out more about how is this different from what CoreOS is doing. Was it inspired by CoreOS? And how it all fits into the system of things. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the show. And yeah, I know we do so many things, containery, Dockery, hosting services, things like that. But this I think has got some interesting potential. So I'm glad we got him on.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is kind of funny. I know while you were away, we had the 400th episode of Floss Weekly. We're already up to 403, but we did play some of the clips. So if the people are watching or listening miss that, you might want to go back and relive some of the history of Floss Weekly. And we played Randall's first time as host during those snippets. But this actually goes all the way back, like you said, to episode 18 when Josh was on. And that was your first time as a co-host, I believe, even before you took over the show. So we're going to bring those guys on in just a minute. I know everyone's going to be excited about this episode. I certainly am. But before we do, we have to take just a minute and thank the people that make this show possible. And that starts with Braintree. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. You know what? Maybe next week, maybe next year, there could be a whole new way to pay for things. Maybe it'll be the next Bitcoin, maybe the next Apple Pay, maybe even both at the same time. Who knows? Fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. They accept everything from pounds to PayPal to the next big innovation from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes along, all you have to do is update a few lines of code. They make it really easy to implement this thing. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. They offer simple, secure payments and code that you can integrate quickly. They have SDKs in 7 languages, programming languages, that is. So if you're a .NET kind of person or a Java person or a Python person like me or even a pro person like Randall, you can actually integrate Braintree into your site. They have elegant code with clear documentation. In fact, we're looking at actually using Braintree for at Benicia Makerspace to accept our membership payments. Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with one integration. Integrating it into your app is as easy as inserting, like I said, just a few lines of code. You can learn more at BraintreePayments.com/floss. We thank them for their support of Floss Weekly. So now let's bring on our guests. So our first guest, we have two guests today, actually. Our first guest is Josh Burke, as he coordinates container communities for Red Hat and works with Atomic Host, Docker, Kubernetes, Atomic App, and many other cloud container tools, and we'll ask him about what's going on, how we transition from Postgres and all that kind of stuff. And our second guest is Colin Walters. He works on Project Atomic with a focus on Atomic Host for Red Hat. Specific active areas are the upstream CI/CD in CentOS and Docker storage and the system containers at the Atomic Command. So we're going to ask him what all that stuff is and what he does in just a minute. So let's go ahead and bring these guys on, Josh and Colin. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Great. Josh, you know, it's been a while since you've been on. I think we figured out before the show started something like 7 years, but welcome back to Floss Weekly.
Thanks. Glad to be here. It's always been a fun show.
Yeah, definitely. And tell us a little bit, just for those who might not have caught up or followed your career progress here over the years, how did you end up going from Postgres that you worked on before? I know we crossed paths at Sun when you were doing Postgres work. How did you make the transition from that over to Red Hat working on Project Atomic?
I've been doing a lot of ops consulting on PostgreSQL, and a good portion of my work centered around trying to automate high availability PostgreSQL. Mm-hmm. When Docker was introduced, I seized on Linux containers as actually a really good way to help with automating high availability Postgres. Containers actually, it has less to do with the container technology itself and more to do with simplifying your administration picture. One of the classic problems with high availability Postgres is something known as stoneth, so shoot the other node in the head. That is, if a particular Postgres node is supposed to be down, how do you make sure it's down? And the nice thing about running a service in a container is that if you can shut off the container, you know the service isn't running. So a lot of the new container tools and container orchestration tools really gave us that. And so that got me involved in Docker. The other reason why Docker was appealing to me was, of course, I was back in 2006, 2007, I was on the Solaris team, making use of Solaris zones to run Postgres in, mm-hmm. mainly for resource management. And so from that perspective, Linux containers is, hey, I get to use this wonderful new tool again that I've missed since OpenSolaris, you know, since right. Sun was acquired by Oracle and OpenSolaris kind of ceased to be a competitive force. And then when I started doing a whole lot of that, a friend of mine at Red Hat pointed out this position was open, and it was an opportunity to sort of do full-time work on open source stuff instead of having to balance it against consulting. That was how I came to move over to this.
Yeah, great. That's awesome. I'm going to ask you to kind of define Project Atomic, and specifically we're going to talk today about Atomic Host in just a minute. But I wanted to hop over to Colin because I gave you a brief introduction there. But tell everyone what your role is with Project Atomic.
Yeah, so like the intro said, I do a lot of work on Atomic Host and our CI efforts. One of the big parts about Project Atomic is that we have a branch of Docker with some patches, which is a subject in the media recently. Some of those patches are pretty important, and so help out with those. So I guess a good example is we have a patch that allows containers when they're run to inherit, we call them secrets, but it's really kind of configuration from the host. So a canonical example might be if you need a container to access content that's protected by a client certificate for access, that's where we still carry a patch to allow injective admin container. So it's a wide variety of stuff, but the main really, besides all the peripheral stuff, the main thing I do is I'm the upstream maintainer of the OS3 and RPM OS3 projects, which are the tool to update the host operating system in an atomic fashion.
You said CI, I mentioned CI/CD. Is that continuous integration, continuous development?
Continuous delivery, yeah. So we have a stream in CentOS that that I help maintain that's basically tracking Git master of a bunch of our different projects, like the atomic command and OS3 and RPM OS3 and a variety of projects. One of the things that it also does, a challenge for us has actually been maintaining a bunch of different streams. You know, we have Fedora, we have CentOS, and Fedora has multiple releases. And one of the things that I'm trying to do is basically for the components we care about, like Docker and Kubernetes and OS3, and like the thing and the atomic command, the things that are kind of important about Project Atomic is to try and version lock them between Fedora and CentOS so we're not maintaining too many independent streams, if that makes sense. So that's one of the things that this tool does. It basically tracks Fedora builds and automatically rebuilds them for CentOS.
Okay. Well, I'm going to come back to this because I want to find out from you, Colin, what the relationship is between Red Hat, Fedora, CentOS, and this in just a minute, but I want to go back to Josh real quick and ask him about what's the overall goal of Project Atomic and specifically Atomic Host. What is it for someone that is just new to this? Maybe they don't know a whole lot about it. What problem are you trying to solve, and how are you doing that?
So Project Atomic is actually an umbrella project. It's really more of a meta project. That contains at this point something like 30 different projects for Red Hat in the container space. And the main goal is just to make containers production operational, including for large enterprises. some things have changed over the last year, but I'll tell you, when I got involved with Docker back in version 0.4, version 1, that sort of thing, Docker was really nice for development, but wasn't useful for an actual production deployment. Too many things were missing. And Red Hat staff saw that too, and decided to add a lot of the things that were missing. And Red Hat had its own way of doing that. Now, the mainstream Docker project and Docker Inc. has been adding their own version of the missing operations pieces. But Red Hat has its version based on a lot of experience supporting large enterprise customers. And so this includes things like a bunch of Docker patches, patches on the mainstream Docker project itself to make it integrate better with enterprise tools to do other things. Atomic Host, which we'll be talking about more later, the Atomic CLI, which is a wrapper command line tool to allow you to do a number of different things with containers that normally require a number of different tools to do, Atomic App, which is a tool for composing, that is writing a script to create a multi-container application, so an application that spans more than one container. Because you might have like a web container and a database container and a proxy container, et cetera. And the Atomic Developer Bundle, which is a virtual machine image for Windows and Mac OS users who want to work on Kubernetes and Docker and OpenShift and a bunch of other container stuff. And then sort of in a host of other projects. And this includes both things that get used in Red Hat products. Like, for example, a big part of the purpose of a lot of the stuff we have in Project Atomic is to actually provide a platform that OpenShift can be run on top of.
Mm-hmm.
But not everything. Some things are separate from that. Some things are experimental because this whole, you know, container ecosystem is rapidly evolving. And so to keep up with it, Red Hat engineers will experiment with new approaches and new designs for tools. And those generally go under Project Atomic because it is a pure open source upstream area and we don't have to worry about, you know, the Red Hat doesn't have to worry about support for these things. And so engineers can experiment with new approaches.
Yeah. Well, I've really been impressed with what Red Hat's been doing lately with
OpenStack, for example, and you mentioned OpenShift as well.
Yeah.
Real quickly, just maybe a 50 word overview of what OpenShift is, just in case people don't know.
So OpenShift is a platform, is a container based platform as a service offering. The idea is that if you want to take application code and you want to deploy it to a cloud of machines and run the application code as a container, as part of your application infrastructure, then you'd use OpenShift. Comparable projects would be Deus or DCOS, which have very sort of similar feature sets and goals.
Right. Yeah, I know. I've used OpenShift. I still have an account. I used it a few years ago. I was really impressed. I think it was an acquisition by Red Hat. Yeah. Was really impressed with how it worked, you know, seamlessly, and how it was built for it. Simple yet fine-grained enough knobs that you can go in and tune things like I/O and things like that for your application needs. Really cool project. And I think we had them on the show, Randall saying, we had them on the show back in 2012. So people can go back and listen to that, but it has changed somewhat since then. Why isn't OpenShift just included under Project Atomic? It sounds like that's a separate beast.
Yeah, mostly because OpenShift is a product. OpenShift came into Red Hat, as you mentioned, in kind of a different way because it was an acquisition. I think it was an acquisition. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I believe
anyway,
it was.
Anyway, OpenShift started out as OpenShift Online. It started out as an online service, and then became also a product and a project you could download. And for that reason, it's been kind of different. The other thing is we actually kind of want to keep the separation there. That is, Project Atomic is there for people who want to build their own stuff. And OpenShift is there for people who are like, I have some code, I just want to run it in containers. And I just want it to work. Because we're dealing with both sides, right? Like in your sort of development-only shops, that's what they want. They want the full stack. They want it to just run. On the other hand, when you're dealing with a lot of larger shops, particularly a lot of Red Hat Enterprise customers, because ultimately, you know, customers feed into this because that's how I get paid and Colin gets paid. They have very strong ideas of how their infrastructure should be built. And for that reason, they don't necessarily want the full stack as is. Because, for example, they might already have their own continuous integration toolchain. And they might not want to use the one that ships with OpenShift. And so for that reason, we also want to provide basically the parts so that they can build their own.
Yeah. Well, I know Randall, I don't want to take away any of Randall's questions here, but I know he mentioned CoreOS, and we've had them on the show as well. How would you say this differs from CoreOS?
I can, so they're certainly often compared. There are a number of projects, though, in this space. You know, there's also Rancher OS. There's Ubuntu Core, I think it's called. And Intel also has this project Clear Linux, which has some interesting stuff. It isn't actually container focused. They have this bundle mechanism. I've actually started to write up like a kind of, for a lot of my projects, I try and have a related project section with some relatively unbiased, you know, strengths and weaknesses of them. And I've been meaning to post it. I've only done it for CoreOS and Clear Linux so far. But so to answer, you know, specifically for CoreOS, you know, they do have a similar focus as being between CoreOS and Atomic Host as being a small base that you can use to run containers, specifically OCI or Docker formatted containers. The underlying update mechanisms are pretty different. And one of the things I think is superior about the Atomic Host RPMO stream model is that in the most recent releases, and we haven't fully updated the website to reflect this, but it's more of a hybrid mode of image and package-based updates, which is where we're going for with the beginning. So the idea is kind of, yes, you have an immutable base that you replicate and it's tested and assembled, but you can add to it in a pretty seamless fashion. And I think that level of flexibility makes image-based updates a lot more powerful as far as being a hybrid. But, you know, in the upstream communities, you'll definitely see Project Atomic people in CoreOS people working together on different things. So, for example, there's a new GitHub organization called Containers, I think, and there's a bunch of different projects there where we're trying to work in the upstream OCI and standards communities on standardizing parts of the Docker and OCI ecosystem, and as well as in Kubernetes.
Well, I want to come back to that question I asked you while we're still kind of setting the stage at this level for people that may not be familiar with this stuff. And that's what is the relationship? I mean, you're probably in a good position to tell us, because you're it sounds like you're maintaining a lot of the software as it comes upstream. So what's the relationship? You got Red Hat, you've got Fedora, and then you've got CentOS or CentOS, depending on, I sometimes mix those up. And now you've got Atomic Host. So what's the relationship between the four of those?
Yeah, okay, so Atomic Host is not a distribution. This is a really important aspect of this. Like, we're the upstream for a number of technologies, but the actual builds happen in the distribution. So you're getting the same set of packages when you run Fedora Atomic Host as when you just run Yum. And I think that's really an essential aspect of that things, in that, you know, we're not trying to make a new distribution with its own security update stream and all that stuff, because we already have enough of those. So our builds in CentOS are also like, We're not trying to make a new distribution there. It's like they're also deriving from the CentOS content. If that makes sense.
Yeah, to put it in one sentence, you don't actually download Atomic Host as a separate thing. There's a Fedora Atomic Host, and there's a CentOS Atomic Host, and there's actually a Red Hat Atomic Host that's a supported product.
Mm. And so I'm a little curious now, because I'm hearing a lot of these terms bandied about. But so I see the examples of getting started with Atomic Host, and it's got RHEL. And I'm wondering, wait, I thought RHEL was the one I have to pay for. Is this also going to be the same examples if I'm using CentOS or a Fedora, depending on where I want to be, bleeding edge or something that's tested?
Yeah, pretty much, except that when things change, because we changed the platform because we've added new features. So, like, for example, one of our engineers, Giuseppe, published a blog post yesterday on the new system containers, and that's currently available in our most sort of bleeding edge distribution, which is the CentOS Continuous that Colin maintains. But you can't actually use that on the other editions because the last one to be updated will be the Red Hat Atomic, because that has to be the most stable version.
Okay, that makes more sense then. Okay, so even though I'm seeing RHEL there, which is, again, the one I pay for, I don't have that incorrect there. Okay, right. I could actually still be community supported and go to a CentOS version and do roughly the same thing.
Yes.
Okay, awesome. Now, let's step back and take another direction at this, because this is something that still I find very confusing about Docker and development. So obviously Docker and all of its things around it are all about deploy. But what am I doing? What's on my laptop in the midst of all this? How am I building and testing apps with something like Atomic Host? How do I run Atomic Host software also on my laptop? Or how does that work?
Well, you could actually. I think Colin is. Or Atomic Workstation.
So I tend to use Vagrant for running Atomic Hosts. So we do have a project that's kind of focused on what you're talking about. It doesn't use Atomic Host right now, but it uses just regular Yum-based CentOS, and it's called the Atomic Developer Bundle. And it's kind of intended to be a Vagrant-based system. And it includes all the way up to OpenShift. The idea there is, so there's kind of two container-based workflows. One is if you're using Linux as your desktop, you can definitely run Docker directly on your workstation. And that can be a really powerful model. It can be a lot nicer and better than using virtualization for testing apps locally, like directly on your workstation. But, you know, there's kind of a huge segment of the developer market that uses Mac OS X and Windows. And So obviously you can't run Linux containers directly on those. So the virtualization-based workflow, especially with Vagrant, can be a pretty convenient way to kind of do builds. So there you kind of have your source code on your workstation. And when you do build, you're SSHing into the VM, which could be Atomic Host or another system running Docker, that sort of thing.
Well, there's a Docker for OS 10, so I could be. In fact, I am running that for a couple little applications that I've tried. But it looks like at that point, would I need to have a different sort of Docker build script that then also? I mean, I'm thinking of the example where I've got my deploy, and the deploy includes like some web pages and some, web applications and things like that. But then I'm going to want to tweak that. But that seems to all be in the read-only stuff. Is there ways to get like temporarily replacing a file so I can try something new? I'm sorry if this is such a basic question, but this is still something that's puzzling me about how this all works.
Yeah. So let me talk a little bit about immutability, if that's okay, because that's a lot of the motivation for this. So part of the idea of both Atomic Host and containers is the goal is to get to something known as immutable infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And the easiest way to explain that is historically the way that we deployed things to servers was deploy then configure.
Right.
That is, you install a base OS like CentOS or Fedora or RHEL that's just a generic version. And then you either by hand or more frequently using configuration management tool like Puppet or Chef would go ahead and configure that system in place.
Right.
And that's a great system for one or two servers. But when you're managing 200 or 900 or 1,000 servers, it starts to feel there's some limitations of scale there. Particularly both the configuration management itself becomes a deployment speed bottleneck, although obviously all of those projects are working on speeding that up. And more importantly, if you're configuring after deploy, you're going to have a certain number of failures and variants in what happens during that configure stage after deploy.
Uh-huh.
And from an ops perspective, those become a huge headache, right? You spend most of your time dealing with the exceptions. So the idea of immutable infrastructure is you do it the other way. You say, what I'm going to do first is I'm going to configure something and I'm going to make that configured version of the thing into an image. And then I'm going to deploy that image to multiple places, but it's already pre-configured. So configuration doesn't need to be done after deployment. And at scale, this is a much more reliable approach. And so for applications in user space, containers do this for the applications, right? You have your container image, you do the deploy. The deploy is immutable. And on the OS level, Atomic Host or CoreOS or Ranch or whatever you want to use, but Atomic Host does that on the OS level. The idea that, again, you do your configuration upstream and then you do an immutable deploy. So when you're talking about development and, oh, hey, I need to change a few web pages or whatever, there's an approach to that which needs to funnel things into the sort of immutable infrastructure concept that says, hey, most of the container image should be immutable. And a few things are allowed to change. And those are handled differently because we know they're allowed to change. So like the usual way to handle things that are going to be different at deploy time is you stick them on a volume on storage, right? So say, for example, you have this general container image of, hey, this is going to run Django or Mod Perl or whatever my web stack is, but it needs to pull the latest version of the website code. And so you put that latest version of the website code on shared storage. You deploy it through Kubernetes. You use a persistent volume so that it pulls the copy of that website code from the shared storage, and you get the latest version when you deploy.
Okay, that makes a little more sense. I mean, I always thought it was hilarious. Well, not hilarious, like I'm laughing out of my chair, but at almost every client I've been at in the last decade or so, they have dozens of machines And when we're rolling out a new release, we're running CPAN installs on every single one of the machines. And the odds of that getting a bit-for-bit compatibility are just zero, basically. Yeah. There's no chance of that. So I think I understand a little bit better, but that's always sort of puzzled me. I'll probably better that I sit down with somebody and actually walk through an example, I guess, probably for that. Let's slide sideways again a little bit, though, and talk about Atomic's goals. And is there anybody else in this space that you're borrowing from and exchanging with? I know you mentioned CoreOS a little bit earlier, but is this sort of like the most mature in this space already? Oh boy. Yeah, not that you want to take that, huh?
Yeah.
I guess you can always have different, depends on the metrics, right? But I think a strength of Project Atomic, if you compare it to other things in the space, is that we are building from established distributions. And in particular, one of the things that most interests me is the whole packages versus containers and how that impacts things like configuration management. So where I'm going with this is that, so for example, in Fedora and CentOS, we also produce a Docker base image, which is pretty essential for, it's also built on the same stream. So here you have, you know, say OpenSSL is on your host, and it's also in the container base image, and you know, you still need to keep that up to date. So I think from that perspective, we're very mature. Like, it's a pretty complete solution of software updates, transitioning from the kind of previous model, which is where, you know, you use Yum or apt-get or something like that to install all the software directly on the host without using containers. You know, I think we have a pretty complete picture of, okay, here's how I still get all my software updated, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and the other thing that I'll stress with this is, in addition to our external production users, OpenShift, so the supported OpenShift product runs on Atomic Ghost and in a lot of the Atomic tools. And so anything we release in the stable versions is going to work in production because it has to work for us.
Now, this is you said this is an umbrella, Atomic Section umbrella, and Atomic Host is one of the instances of that. How is the governance for this then strictly Red Hat deciding futures and stuff, or is there community input? Are you getting patches from the community?
Depends on which project you're talking about specifically. So, there's heavy overlap with a lot of external open source projects, and for that reason, a lot of the governance happens there. So, for example, governance for Fedora Atomic Host happens through the Fedora project. For CentOS Atomic Host happens through the CentOS project.
You're right.
And for that matter, you know, our main emphasis is the Docker Kubernetes stack. And so a bunch of things go through the Kubernetes project, which has its own, you know, incorporated governance. For a lot of the smaller projects, for things like Atomic CLI and that sort of thing, currently it's what you call sort of GitHub governance. As in, there's a bunch of engineers working on it, most of whom work for Red Hat. And we have patches and stuff that come into there, but the projects are not big enough yet to actually need some form of formal governance. Yeah. You know, and other things will happen in the future. Like, for example, we've been working a lot, like system containers deals with run C and OCI based containers. So eventually that might actually go under the OCI. In the future, in which case that'll be the governance for that. It has to be much more fully baked before that happens. But so there's no governance for Project Atomic overall. In except me. And the senior members of Red Hat Developer Tools and the senior members of Platform and that sort of thing, because the sort of main umbrella doesn't actually hold anything, if you follow me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is all good stuff. I know I've got a lot of questions while Randall's been asking. I've been writing things down and thinking of stuff. And we even have a question from the audience, which we always like to take. So I'm going to ask that one as soon as we come back. But first, we've got to pay the bills. And so we've got another interesting thing to talk about just for a second. Then we'll come back and ask that question from the audience. But first, we need to talk about Drobo. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but actually Drobo was started. The founder had actually lost his honeymoon photos, and he had a hard drive crash. And even though he had a RAID array and everything, and he thought he had them covered, his backup actually failed. I didn't realize this. So he sought out to create a better redundant storage solution, and then voila, Drobo was born. It's been going strong ever since. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. They invented a new technology, it's an award-winning technology actually, called Beyond RAID, to solve the limitations of traditional RAID that traditional RAID imposes, like not being able to expand capacity, having to use the same size drives, vulnerability to data corruption and power outages, et cetera, et cetera. Beyond RAID actually lets users easily add capacity to a live storage array while mirroring your existing data. To increase capacity, you just add a drive or replace a smaller drive with a bigger one, and everything gets bigger. They have a battery-backed cache to prevent write failure or data corruption in a power outage. And Drobos are really simple to use. You just add or swap drives. You don't need any tools or anything like that. There's easy-to-read status lights, so you know when you're running out of space. They offer models with 4 to 12 drive bays, providing up to 64 terabytes of protected storage. They also connect directly to your Mac or PC using Thunderbolt or USB 3, and there are network-attached Drobos as well. The Drobo 5N and 810N are network storage systems, and what's exciting about those is that their capabilities can be extended with Drobo apps, which are free and installed from the dashboard. If you're upgrading to a new 128 or 256 gig iPhone 7, so if you do, you should plan to shoot 4K. Maybe you're shooting 4K video on your iPhone 7 Plus. If you do, the Drobo Pics works app works great with your phone to automatically back up your photos and videos in full uncompressed quality whenever you're on your home Wi-Fi. I think they're great. Being in the storage industry for so long, I think these systems are great for beginners. If you're looking to get started, expand, get more storage. Who doesn't need more storage these days with all the photos we're taking? Definitely Drobo is a good thing to take a look at. You can visit drobostore.com to learn more and check out their complete line of products. And Twit listeners can actually save $100 off the purchase of select Drobo models, including the Drobo 5N at drobostore.com by using the discount code TWIT100. That's drobostore.com and use the code TWIT100. And we thank Drobo for their support of Floss Weekly. Perfect fit in here. All right, let's get back to the questions, and especially want to ask a question from the audience. This comes from the Gem Doctor or the Gem DR. Josh, you were talking about immutable storage, and he says, wouldn't an immutable storage be dependent on the restricted hardware requirements? And so this gets into the area of virtual. It seems like we've got virtual layers on top of virtual layers these days. But where do, when you're making these immutable, for lack of a better word, container images, I'll call them, aren't they dependent on the hardware that you're deploying this, or are they completely independent?
They're dependent on architecture. So you can't deploy a container image that's built for x86-64 to an ARM system. And that's actually something we've been discussing lately, because there's a lot of the Internet of Things community has an even stronger interest in immutable infrastructure than the web services community does, because when you've got a device that's possibly at the end of a weak network connection that doesn't have a console on it, you need updates to either just work or fail and roll back automatically, because you can't troubleshoot it if it gives you a weird, wacky error message, because it's in the customer's place of business or in their house. So for that reason, we're looking at things, and there's now a PR open for Kubernetes to have the Kubernetes container orchestration system handle the idea of architecture so that you could have, say, a mixed architecture environment. But aside from architecture, there aren't really other hardware dependencies, because containers encapsulate user space rather than, like, they run off of the kernel of the host OS. That's the difference between a container and virtualization, right? A virtualization has a complete software environment, including the kernel for the guest OS.
Mm-hmm.
Containers, on the other hand, virtualize the layers above the kernel. They virtualize user space, but not the kernel. And that's why they're much lighter weight and smaller and faster to deploy. And the other advantage of them being a shared kernel is only the host OS has to support your hardware. Otherwise, the container is portable.
Right.
Now, if you're going to have things like persistent volumes, then that gets into a lot of deployment-specific stuff. Because as much as places like the Kubernetes project try to make the interfaces for things like persistent volumes generic, the fact is that a Gluster volume doesn't really behave exactly the same as a Ceph volume, let alone an NFS volume. And so when you get into actual sort of production deployments, you end up having to come up with a lot of specifics for these little bits, for things like storage, for shared secrets, for passwords, you know, other things that are particular to deployment. And that's actually why in Project Atomic, our development tools people are actually really hard at work at trying to improve that situation, because we have the development situation where the developer wants to simulate the production environment on their laptop, including things like shared secrets and volumes, so they can run it on their laptop almost exactly the way it would run in production, because that's how you get a more reliable continuous integration. So that's where, for example, the Atomic App project came from, was an attempt to actually do that, to say, hey, you can run this using several Docker containers with just regular Docker in your laptop, and then you can turn it around and deploy it to OpenShift or Kubernetes, and it'll run the same way. And that's still a work in progress, because all of the underlying software is changing so rapidly. But that's sort of the idea. So, but again, to answer the person's question, in terms of the containers themselves, the only thing they're really dependent on is architecture. Beyond that, they use whatever kernel modules, et cetera, you have. So the containers don't care what the rest of your hardware is.
And I wanted to ask about that. You brought up deployment, and I'm thinking, okay, well, you're using this for OpenShift. Is the goal to have a company? Let's say a lot of companies that I work with, they run stuff, you know, in their own data center, but then they also run stuff on Amazon AWS, or, you know, maybe they'll go to a third party like Orange or Verizon and use their cloud services to run stuff there. Is this something that you could standardize around for, you know, all of the places that you want to run your apps or develop your apps? Could you use Atomic Host in that way to kind of simplify deployment across different infrastructure types?
Absolutely. So that's one of the important goals of the project, and the technology as well is basically orthogonal to virtualization. And what I mean by that is that you can run Atomic Host on bare metal, or you can run it in an infrastructure as a service environment like Amazon Web Services or Google Compute Engine and those sort of things. So, and more to the point, we try and have basically the packaged or component versions that go into it behave exactly the same across them. When you go up the stack a little bit, you know, if you start using Kubernetes or something like that beyond just Docker, Kubernetes has a bunch of plugins. So, for example, if you're in an OpenStack environment or an AWS environment, it can automatically use the IIS storage types to back end your containers. If you're in a bare metal environment, then that's where you turn to Gluster or Ceph or something like that. I mean, or iSCSI. I mean, a bunch of different storage types. But, you know, the core technology model definitely applies across both bare metal and infrastructure as a service environments.
Yeah. Well, we've talked on this show. The other thing I wanted to ask is we've talked on this show about Flocker, In fact, we just talked to the Cluster HQ folks. I don't know. It seems like it was just yesterday, but I think it's 5 or 6 episodes ago. And so I'm kind of curious, since you mentioned storage and the fact that, you know, Gluster and Ceph, and there's some special things you have to kind of be aware of with containers and how they interact with those file systems. But what about using some of the technology, especially when you want to make copies of containers and move containers around and things like that in terms of the storage? How do you integrate with those types of technologies, or do you integrate with those types of technologies?
Yeah, so I think it comes down to the individual component. Like another good example might be the Docker registry component. We have a branch of the Docker registry called Atomic Registry and Project Atomic, and how you store containers. So a common model, if, for example, you're in Amazon, is to use S3. If you're in OpenStack, it's Swift. So you can basically backend your Docker registry with the infrastructure, like key value store. That's a really common pattern. And key value stores map really well to the kind of immutable blob that Docker or OCI image is, like the series of layers. So that's a really common integration point. Another major one is around networking. So Kubernetes has a model where there's an IP per pod, and this like requires some infrastructure setup. So that's one of those ones where if you're thinking about how I network all my containers together, you have to think of it. It can definitely be different depending on which environment you're in and how you set that up.
Yeah, that was actually a question I wanted to ask. So I'm glad you answered it. Where is it? It's in here somewhere. Anyway, one of the guests asked, it was DAW Desktop. That's right. DAW Desktop was asking about networking solutions and how these things work in a network. Of course, I'm a storage guy, so I'm interested in how it works with storage. I mean, this is kind of a new paradigm, and we've been dealing with virtual environments for a long time. As Josh mentioned, we were working with OpenSolaris back in the day. Containers were a big deal, hard partition containers and soft partition containers. And now it seems like containers are taking over the world. So I wanted to ask too. I just lost my train of thought. Oh yeah. So if I wanted to, getting back to where you deploy this and how you deploy it, what if I just wanted to? I guess if I wanted to make use of this as a service, are there people out there using this in the back end of their service offering already? I mean, you mentioned that you guys use this for OpenShift, but if I just wanted to run my apps and make use of this to deploy apps and keep everything going running more easily with Atomic Host, can I do that as a service offering, or do I have to deploy my own infrastructure?
Are you asking if you can do that on top of public cloud, or?
Well, we know we can do it. That's the question I just asked, is you can do it. So there's a difference between me deploying my own stuff on a public cloud service, right? And is there a technology that's out there that uses this on the back end of their service the way OpenShift does? Maybe that's the answer, is just use OpenShift. I don't know.
To have Atomic Host as a platform.
Yes, yes.
And then you put all your stuff on top of it.
Yes.
There isn't at this time.
Okay.
There are people who we have community members who are using Atomic Host in production, but yeah, they built their own stuff either on their own hardware or on top of public cloud. Now whether or not there might be an Atomic Host service in the future, or whether there might be an Atomic Host service offering from one or more public clouds, could certainly happen. We certainly wouldn't mind it if it happened. But there isn't anything right now.
So yeah, I mean there are a couple different levels to this to build on that. So one of the things we actually didn't mention is OpenShift. The version you're using before is V2 is radically different in V3, because in V3 it's based on Docker and Kubernetes. So OpenShift is basically a distribution of Kubernetes V3 with a lot of PaaS features. So when you're using, so if you want more like a container infrastructure as a service is how I say it, then OpenShift Online V3 will definitely fill that role. And you know, all the same technologies that we're putting in Project Atomic, like so our maintenance of, for example, the Docker SE Linux policy is also part of Project Atomic. And so all that integration work goes into OpenShift Online V3. There is some effort in Google Compute Engine to have a Google Kubernetes, so basically a model where you bring your own host and they'll run Kubernetes for you, which is kind of an interesting cut. But I think for most people, if they really want it more as a service, you'll kind of be interacting more with Kubernetes or like a container infrastructure management tool than you would directly with an atomic host or the underlying Docker engine. And one of the reasons for that right now is Docker itself, like the underlying engine, doesn't really have any security or access control. Like basically as soon as you can access it, you can kind of take control of the machine. So whereas Kubernetes does have, and this is one of the things that OpenShift is driving into Kubernetes, is basically security policy constraints and that sort of thing that's going to be used for OpenShift Online.
And actually, so just speaking of Kubernetes, this is a curiosity of mine. Is the orchestration for the atomic umbrella all being focused down into Kubernetes, or are there other projects in this umbrella that are about specifically about orchestration?
Kubernetes is our main platform because it's what we use and because we have a lot of reasons to like Kubernetes, not the least of which is that it's a community-driven multi-company project under nonprofit governance, which is just, a much more comfortable environment for us and feels like it's a lot more future-proof than projects that are under a single company. A lot of, our stuff is going to be focused around Kubernetes. Like if you look at the getting started with Project Atomic, part of what it goes through is setting up Kubernetes on Atomic Host. Like I said, one of the things about Project Atomic is that it's for people who want to build their own. And so there are instructions and tools and that sort of thing for how you would use, say, Mesos Marathon. On Atomic Host or with some of the other Atomic tools. Like Atomic App, for example, has support for Mesos Marathon, which has been a popular alternative or complement to Kubernetes for orchestration. And this is where we get into the weird and wacky, wonderful world of layers, because mm-hmm. Mesos Marathon gets used instead of Kubernetes in some environments, but also gets used in addition to Kubernetes in some environments.
Mm.
Particularly people will literally stack Kubernetes on top of Mesos, where they use Mesos to deploy Kubernetes to lots of mini clusters. And we get the same thing. I mean, one of the things, because people ask us, OpenShift versus OpenStack. And I said, well, we regard them kind of as complements because we've had people do, projects both where they were running OpenShift in virtual machines on top of OpenStack, or alternately running all the OpenStack components in containers on top of OpenShift. You dive into any of these things, and for people who have sort of large production use cases, it ends up being turtles all the way down. And so like I said, part of the idea of having all of the different pieces and all of the different sub-projects is that people do want to swap out things, and people do swap out things. For example, one of the questions we had earlier from the audience was involving like the network layer. And the way that the network layer works within Kubernetes is you give it a specific plugin that is a software-defined networking system. The default one is Flannel. So Flannel is a CoreOS project, and it's based on writing a whole bunch of information to the etcd, distributed configuration store, and then it pulls that information to determine sort of the shape of the network so that each of your pods in Kubernetes, which is a small group of containers, gets its own IP. But you're not required to use Flannel. As a matter of fact, OpenShift uses what's the name of it? Colin, what's the name of the OpenShift network?
I think it's just known as OpenShift SDN.
Oh, okay, it's based on something else, though, that has a general upstream community. Yeah. So you can swap that out, and some people do because, like any other piece of infrastructure, these software-defined networking systems have some steep trade-offs in terms of usability versus performance versus scalability versus other things. And people do, like, because they have an investment in a particular infrastructure and therefore they want to swap things out.
At what point does this become, does this scale? It's probably a backwards word I'm thinking. If I've just got a couple of hosts running my website and maybe in some sort of light HA fashion, like a, just a round robin DNS or something, does this make sense to even look at anything under the Atomic umbrella, or should I stay down more towards, say, the OpenShift umbrella, or just Docker deployed on a couple of machines? I mean, when does this start to make sense for managers and technicians to look at?
So I would definitely say we want to cover the small end as well. So we're actually undergoing a transition right now where Kubernetes was originally included with Atomic Host, but one of the things we found is it's moving very fast and people want to bring their own or manage their own. So obviously OpenShift is its own distribution of Kubernetes. So, but we're transitioning it out to be an add-on. And by that, the core is shrinking down so that if you're not at the point where you need to run a cluster, I think an Atomic Host model still makes sense. Like, so I have a server at home that's running Atomic Host and it's not part of a cluster or anything like that. Because it's just one server that handles data. But, you know, I use a hybrid of containers and software directly on the host. So, yes, I think the answer is containers are definitely worth it, even at the small scale.
Yeah, that's interesting because, this stuff just blows my mind. We've been talking about it a lot, and it seems like it's all developing in real time, very similar to the way virtualization developed. When it first started, it just kind of all of a sudden it was like you heard about it and the next thing you hear, it's just exploded everywhere. And I think the same is true with containers now. And they're such a great tool. People are really making use of them. We're coming up to the end of the show here, but there is a couple questions I wanted to ask. One of them is, you know, there's also something called Flatpak, which kind of is – helps you distribute applications. Is this similar to Flatpak at all?
It's related. Flatpak is a way of packaging applications which usually but doesn't always require containers. I'm not a contributor to Flatpak, and so I'm not clear on all of the architecture stuff. Where this sort of overlaps is one of the things I mentioned is one of our sort of experimental areas is folks in the Fedora project have this thing called Atomic Workstation, which is a different distribution designed for running your laptop atomically. Now, the main reason why they do that is so that they can run Fedora Rawhide, that is the daily build, on their laptops. And when it breaks the laptop, which it does every other day or every third day, they can roll back without losing anything. But then that means that all of your user applications then need to be packaged up in some way that allows you to deploy them on an Atomic platform. And they sort of turn to Flatpak for that. And Flatpak running in containers. So there is overlap there. Flatpak is on the desktop side. So you wouldn't expect to see Flatpak applications in a cloud server environment. But definitely on your developer workstation environment. And the developer workstation then might be running an Atomic OS.
Hmm. Interesting. And let's go back to Colin for this other one too, because, there was something mentioned earlier, or maybe I just heard about you guys talking about it, but it's something called OS Tree. What is OS Tree?
Yeah, so really briefly, there's a couple layers, but OS Tree predates Docker. It's a tool that is still pretty focused on being a mechanism to snapshot like a set of packages normally, or it could be software, it's not packaged necessarily, but and do an atomic update of the host OS. And then so what we kind of built on that, on top of that for Atomic Host was this project called RPM OS Tree that we're probably going to rename it at some point, hopefully soon, to have a little bit of a catchier name because it's got more functionality now. But basically integrates the world of RPMs with OSTree. So the idea is you compose a set of RPMs on a server and you get an atomic upgrade of that. And that's what's used for atomic host. So circling back to one of the things for, is atomic host its own distribution? No, because we're just using the RPM OSTree tool on the same RPMs that come from Fedora and CentOS with as few tweaks as I can get away with, basically. At some point, we've had to add some special, like, customization of some small bits just to kind of work around small bugs. But we really try and keep that minimal with the idea that the set is the same thing, you know, that gets the same set of security updates and all that sort of thing. So when you run rpm-q openssl, you know, it still has a useful answer for whether or not you're secure.
Right. Right. Great. So I wanted to ask, how do people, well, first of all, let me ask, what's next? I mean, what's coming up in the near future for this project? Anything big, exciting you want to let people know to stay tuned for?
Yeah. So, so one of the things, go ahead, Josh.
Well, I already talked about Atomic Workstation. So go ahead, Colin.
Yeah. So one of the, I was just going to repeat, like, one of the transitions we are in the middle of is how we handle Kubernetes. I think that's going to be, it's going to be interesting because, you know, I want to make it easier to track the upstream Kubernetes and, you know, move faster. So it's going to be interesting. The other one that, of course, I like a lot is, I think the package layering that landed in recent Atomic Host really has made the whole thing more practical. It reaches a lot wider scope than it did before. So it's kind of what I always wanted out of an update tool, is give me that atomically updated base and let me add to it rather than managing the sea of packages. So I'm definitely excited about evolving that more.
Yeah.
And Josh, go ahead. I was just going to come back to you, Josh.
One of the other things that we just added recently, and like I said, blog posted yesterday, is system containers. And this is something a lot of people, not just Red Hat in the container space, have been talking about, which is, I want to run important OS infrastructure in containers, stuff that needs to come up before the OS is fully functional. And system containers is the way that a bunch of the engineers working on the container tools within some of the Project Atomic projects came up with. And I'm fairly excited about it because it takes us away from needing to modify the have a separate distribution tree in order to add some of these components like networking, you know, that we can actually layer those as special system containers. And it means the ability to containerize a whole class of applications and tools that were not considered containerizable before.
Wow. Well, I know Randall and I have been talking behind the scenes, and we both think we could go for hours on this topic. But I did want to ask, where should people go to find out more and to get information about all of certainly Atomic Host, but then all of the Project Atomic projects?
Yep. Well, there's the website, which is projectatomic.io. So that's the website. Because there are so many projects and so many things are moving, I recommend also joining somewhere where you can actually interact with folks, because it can be a little bit confusing given the 30 different or whatever different sub-projects. So right now that's either the mailing list, which you can sign up with from the website, or the Atomic channel on irc.freenode.net. We will probably have a Slack channel sometime soon for people who like Slack. So those would be the places to go.
Great. Yeah, I'm getting sucked into Slack in a couple of areas now. I'm still not sure I understand exactly how to use it efficiently. But anything that we didn't talk about, and we'll go to Josh first on this question, anything that we didn't talk about and you guys, oh, I wish we could have mentioned this last thing. Josh, anything like that?
I think we covered a lot of stuff, actually.
Okay, Colin, how about you?
I just want to highlight, I guess, that everything that we do work on is free and open source software. And, you know, that's really important to me in particular. And so, you know, related to the topic of this show, I think we're trying to build a welcoming community around that, those projects. So if you do try and get involved, yeah, that's our goal.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what this show is all about. And a community is so important for any project like this to really be successful, I believe. I believe in community greatly, and it's super important for these things. What? There's two last questions that we ask. I know I said we're wrapping up, but there's always two questions we ask, and we get in trouble if we don't ask them. And I don't think, Randall, that you were asking these back when you co-hosted with Josh, so maybe you were and I forgot. But we're going to go to Josh first and ask these questions. The first one is, what's your favorite scripting language?
I think it's still Python right now. It's changed over the years. It's changed over the years and will probably change again, but I'm still with Python.
Yeah, nice. Mine has changed as well. Colin, what's your favorite scripting language?
Yeah, well, obviously, a lot of the
person whom you're trying to reach.
A lot of the projects that I interact with are in Python, so I would say I don't necessarily always like to write in scripting languages. I'm kind of more of a statically typed person, but you know, it's Python, yeah.
Hmm. And what about the other question we ask is, what's your favorite text editor? Josh, we'll go back to you.
I actually really like Atom. The GitHub text editor. I've been trying to figure out a way to containerize it. I can containerize it on my desktop.
Yeah.
I've been trying to figure out a way to actually deploy it as a server container, which I haven't gotten working yet.
Yeah, I love Atom. I've been using it a lot, and that would actually be really helpful because every time I have to go set it up from scratch, and I know you can copy your config and do all that kind of stuff, but it's kind of a pain to set it up on a different system. So I'm glad to hear you like Atom because I really like it too. Colin, how about you?
Well, yeah, it's funny. Like one of the things that inspired me to get involved in free and open source software was the Emacs startup screen. Like basically I clicked on, I think they have a link to the GPL and copying and free software guidelines. And when I was in college, I kind of read all that and it actually kind of inspired me to get involved. So I actually still use Emacs nowadays, although I switched to VI key bindings, which I guess to some people puts me between the two worlds. Like both camps think I'm evil or something.
Right.
But, you know, I find it's just easier on my pinky not to have to hit control all the time. So it's the Viper mode in Emacs.
That's hilarious. Cute. Yeah, that it does put you in a kind of a weird a weird spot using the VI bindings on Emacs. But as you mentioned, Emacs is one of the very first, it was certainly in the beginning of the whole open source movement with Richard Stallman and all the rest. I'm working on a book right now, and I'm in the appendix. I talk a little bit about Emacs and how Richard was working on that. So very interesting indeed. So anyway, thank you guys. I know, like I said, we could have talked for hours about this. There's still a lot left that we didn't get to. We could have got to. So maybe we'll have you back on the show. We'll talk about some of the other parts of Project Atomic in the future, if you'd be willing to do that.
Sure.
Yeah, of course.
All right, cool. Great. Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
All right, so that was Josh Berkus and Colin Walters of Atomic Host specifically, but they also work, of course, with Project Atomic, and it sounds like a lot of other things. Randall, what do you think about Atomic Host?
Well, you know, this is interesting. I was able to glance at the reader board at the Red Hat Summit and sort of went, oh, this is covering a lot of really interesting areas here. So I'm glad not only did I, you know, immediately recognize Josh and walked up to him and wanted to say hi. And I said, well, what's this all about? And he gave me the quick little description of it. I like that Red Hat's taking a, you know, soup to nuts sort of look at this whole thing, because we've had these piecemeal solutions already. We've had Kubernetes pop up over here. We've had Docker pop up over there, and some virtualization, virtual networking stuff. I think we had one of those as a guest a few weeks back. And it's really nice now to see sort of a all overall solutions coming from a name we know and trust. You know, the whole Red Hat organization has done a lot to really commercialize the Linux space and make it all happen. I'm glad that they were able to get on here. And yeah, like you said, we could have talked with these guys for probably another hour or two easily. We're already running over, so I probably should keep this message short. Anyway, thank you, Aaron. Back to you.
Yeah, we really need to. But what surprises me about this is the complexity that's evolved. I kind of mentioned it a little bit, thinking back to virtualization. But it just seems like, you know, this thing has grown in popularity so quickly, and all of a sudden there's this great need for people to come in and manage that problem of having 900 containers to deploy. And they're identical for the most part, you know, up to a certain, you know, 90% of them are probably identical. They need to be deployed in the same way across the big infrastructure. And it just amazes me. And maybe I'm just getting old, but how this thing has just blown up, the whole container ecosystem has blown up in recent weeks and months, it seems like, but even years, to get to this point. And Red Hat's doing a great job coming in and saying, hey, we know there's some problems that big enterprises need to deal with. They're a great place to tackle this problem. And I love that they're doing it, of course, with open source software. So kudos to them for that.
How many hosts do you think Netflix is running that with nearly identical software on it?
Exactly.
I mean, that's the way to think of this. Yeah, Facebook, all these guys.
Yeah, Apple. I was going to say Yahoo, but you know, we'll see what happens. with Yahoo. Of course, Google. With they've done a lot of work on this as well. And so, yeah, just all these big companies. It's just become the de facto standard for how you deploy and run applications as well as develop applications. So, hugely important. And like I said, we've been talking about it a lot, and we're going to be talking about it some more. Coming up, because I'm going to tell you what's going to come up in just a few weeks here. Coming up on this show on September 20th, we're going to have Jared Smith coming on. He's with Capital One Open Source, a bank that contributes to open source. That's right. Apparently, he's going to tell us all about it. That's Capital One Open Source on September 20th. And then on the 27th, Eric Schultz is going to be on talking about, I want to call it Project Purple, but it's not. It's the Purple Foundation, PRPL, if you want to go Google that. And they're an open source foundation for driving the next generation data center to device, in quotes, solutions. And they do, I think they do cool. QEMU, which is surprising. I think Fabrice Bellard started that, and I've been using QEMU since it started. And then Purple WRT, which I think is a spinoff of OpenWRT for enterprises. So that'll be really interesting. That's on September 27th. October 4th, we have Jesse Noller coming on to talk about Carina, which is an easy-to-use, instant-on native container environment. There you go. We're back to containers. So he says, think instant Docker swarm, literally. So that'll be really interesting. And then on October 11th, we have Christoph Zimmermann, and he was actually supposed to be on earlier, but we had to move him down a little bit because I had some communication problems. But we got him back on. He's on for October 11th, and he's going to be talking about Linux Presentation Day, which is kind of like a Linux conference, but it's for newbies. It's for people that, at least as I understand it, it's for people that haven't used Linux before, and it's to show them how easy it is to use Linux and open source software. So I think that'll be really interesting on October 11th. And speaking of, you're going to be hosting next week, right, with Jared Randall?
That's the goal. So yeah, I mean, presuming I pass the test for this week, I don't know, but yeah, I think I probably got the job back again. So yeah, I'll be hosting the shows as often as I can in the future now for starting next week. Of course, I have my occasional times when I'm out, and then you guys take over again, which works really well for me. So thank you.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I know it's great to have you back. It was great to have you back for this show, specifically given the history, and just wonderful to see you back on. By the way, anything you want to plug before we officially wrap up?
Well, you know, it's funny. We went past all the things that I was plugging for most of the year, and sadly, I missed DragonCon. I phoned in for Hacker 201, but that was really my only presence at DragonCon this year because I was still in the physical rehab, not drug rehab, guys. I wasn't on drug rehab program, physical rehab for getting my balance back. But they let me phone it in, and so I was glad to be on Hacker 201 for at least briefly. I do plan on being a guest next year. Of course, that's always an application process that they say, just because you're a guest 1 year doesn't mean you're a guest the next year, although I've gotten it like 13 years out of the last 15. But if so, then I will be there next year. As far as any other conferences coming up, I am going to be almost nowhere that people can bump into me at, although I'll be in Santa Monica for the week of October 3rd, I guess it is. So if you're in that area, you watch my tweets and see where I'm at, watch my Foursquare check-ins. And I believe the same thing again early November as well. So I'm going to be there about 1 week a month to keep working for my primary client, ZipRecruiter, these days. And I'll be working remotely from Olympia, Washington for almost all the rest of my clients. So not really many places to see me out and about in public. But you can follow me on Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus is where I source my material. I'm also on Facebook, too, pretty loudly for some reason. And I think that's about it for me.
Great. Awesome. Well, great to have you back, as I said, as always. As far as myself, I'm also on Google Plus. I start there and it spreads out. So follow me on Google Plus, but you can also follow me on Facebook or Twitter, whatever you want. I'm Aaron Newcomb on all of the networks that I'm on. And you can follow this show as well at Floss Weekly on Twitter, plus Floss Weekly on Google Plus. You can chat with us. We take questions from the chat room at irc.twit.tv, and you can watch live at live.twit.tv. Oh, and I should mention, coming up, I'll be on Know How this week. So, or if you're a Know How follower, you like to watch Know How here on the Twit Network, I'll be taking over a couple of those shows for Padre, as he's, been called by the Pope to go do something popery. No, that's not the right word. He's been called to do something with his with the Catholic Church. He's doing that, and so I'm going to take over a few of the episodes, or at least be a guest host on some of those. And also, if you missed my appearance on the new Screensavers, go back and watch that too. That was an awfully fun episode, talking to the folks from the High Seas Project out in Hawaii, where they were simulating a Mars living experience for a year. So definitely go check that out. Okay, that's enough plugging. We're done plugging for the show. Thanks for watching. It's been a great experience. And we'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.